Welcome to Technology and the Arts, a bi-weekly podcast exploring the connections between the worlds of technology and art. In this installment, we will discuss some interesting news, websites, and online resources we have come across recently, including the top 100 open source applications for Macs, and recent developments regarding the RIAA. Plus, we'll remember two people who have recently passed away, John's friend Chris Hill, and Rider University professor of political science and noted political analyst David Rebovich. We'll talk about all this and more just ahead on Technology and the Arts for Thursday, October 18th, 2007. Now here are your hosts, Brian Kelly and John Lemazney.
Welcome to another edition of the Technology and the Arts podcast. As always, Technology and the Arts seeks to explore the connections between technology and art, and to establish a forum for discussing the impact technology has made on the human creative process, and on literature, music, and the visual and interactive arts.
And to let you know who we are, my name is Brian Kelly. I have a background in journalism and public relations, and I'm also an amateur songwriter, musician, and science and technology enthusiast living in central New Jersey.
And I'm John Lemazney. I'm a father, artist, musician, poet, and technologist living in New Jersey.
We have a really great show in store for you this week. We haven't talked much about the Recording Industry Association of America, better known as the RIAA, lately, but we will definitely take care of that later in the podcast. But first, John, it's good to see you again. How are you doing?
Very good, Brian. How are you?
I am doing excellent. What have you been up to lately?
Well, one of the things I'm really excited about is last Monday, I gave a presentation on Firefox extensions to the Princeton PC Users Group, which incidentally meets in Lawrenceville, like many of the Princeton computer users groups. And we had a very interesting conversation that had to do with security and abilities and Firefox in general. And generally speaking, we had a fantastic time. A little bit of controversy, but nothing big. And I always appreciate the opportunity to talk to my friends in Princeton and the surrounding area. Oh, and also last Monday, during the day, I gave one of my favorite presentations, technology presentations, to staff and faculty at Rider University on the issue of internet security. Always an interesting and fun topic. I really like to see people's jaws drop when they see what somebody who's trying to get into their information can do with that. And actually, I have another kind of bad piece of news. When I was in high school, I befriended a gentleman by the name of Chris Hill. And one of the things that was great about Chris was his drumming ability. He just was a really tight drummer. And we had a little bit of a reputation amongst our friendly circles as having a really strong sound. And it was really sad. We came to the end of high school. He went to college, I went to college, and we parted ways. Very recently, in the last 2 years or so, I started to talk with him again. He had, of course, come back to the area, and he was married, and he was working in the technology sector, and we met a couple times and played a few times, and it was fun. It was sort of like reminiscing about high school. And then we, you know, time goes on, and you don't get the opportunity to meet with somebody like that every week. So, you know, some time passed, and I had actually left my guitar with him, and he called me up out of the blue and said, "Hey, I have your guitar. You know, how about if we get together? I'll give it back to you. We'll have lunch or whatever." And I had come to find out that he had become separated from his wife, and he had lost his job, and he had these really horrible headaches, these migraines and things. And he was just really kind of sad and upset. So I started to see him about once a month just to sort of, you know, so we could commiserate a little bit. Not that there's anything really wrong with my life. I love my life. But I just felt so bad. It seemed like he was having a bad string of luck. And I talked to him just before he went to California to go see his sister in San Diego. And recently, after he was supposed to get back, I expected to get together with him for our regular, you know, dinner. and I found out that he was found dead in his apartment. And a really good friend of mine, and very mysterious way to go. I mean, he didn't have any terminal diseases that anybody knows about. I have not heard what happened to him. It's very mysterious, though, and just wanted to say rest in peace, Chris Hill, good friend of mine. Very sad to see you go at such an early age. He was 34. How about you, Brian?
Well, in case I haven't apologized enough, I want to say sorry one more time to our listeners for being a day late with the last podcast. As a long-suffering Phillies fan, I didn't really expect him to make the playoffs, so I didn't think it would get in the way of my working on the show. Unfortunately, it did, so please accept my apology. Another reason why I couldn't get the podcast done on time is the fact that my girlfriend and I are taking a 10-week ballroom dancing class in Princeton, New Jersey. So we've only had two classes so far, and we're still on the Foxtrot, which, by the way, is also the name of an excellent early Genesis album. But I think it's going to be really fun. It's going to be interesting to learn how to properly dance for the first time in my life. Finally, to update everyone on something I mentioned in the last podcast, this past week I recorded with my good friend Christian Beach on a cover of David Bowie's 5 Years. I played some organ and provided some backing vocals on the track, which is slated to appear on a Bowie tribute CD to be released by Main Man Records at some point in the near future. I'm going to see if I can get permission to use a brief excerpt of the recording on our podcast at some point. But until then, please check out some other works by Christian Beach by visiting myspace.com/Christian Beach.
While we're on the topic of David Bowie, I just wanted to talk about this one episode of Extras with
Ricky Gervais.
Thank you. Did you ever see the episode with David Bowie in it? It's at the end of the second series,
I think. I saw a clip of it, but I don't remember seeing it.
It's absolutely hilarious. Have to see David Bowie. Not only a brilliant musician and songwriter, but also a pretty damn good actor.
Yes. Oh, also on the topic of music, XPN, which I mentioned a few podcasts ago, is doing a countdown, their annual countdown, and this year it's the top 885 most memorable musical moments. And I had talked on the show about submitting my personal memorable music moment when I went to go see the Amnesty International concert at Giant Stadium in 1986, in June of 86, and Peter Gabriel's performance of Fico, which was just incredible. And I was looking back on the blog that they have set up, which I have a link in the show notes, and found it was in the 500s. I can't remember what number it was, but they have the Amnesty International concerts. And if you click on that link, it talks about Peter Gabriel's involvement. And below that, it says, you know, it has related links. And there's my link, you know, Brian Kelly remembers Eco by Peter Gabriel. So that was kind of cool.
Very cool.
That's about all I've been doing on my end of things. John, anything related to technology and the arts you would like to talk about this week?
One thing that I came across that I really loved was a list of the top 100 best open source Mac software.
Which I love, by the way.
I actually had very little to do with it. It was put out by ajaxflakes.com.
I thank you for sharing it.
Oh, certainly. Of course, a lot of the classic software that we know and love on both Linux and Windows is there, such as Firefox and things like OpenOffice, although on the Mac list, it's actually listed as NeoOffice. But there are also things like the Q emulator. For those of you who have ever heard me speak about portable applications in person, you've probably heard me talk about Qemu, which is essentially a x86 emulator for Windows. You can execute it and then run, for instance, a live CD right inside of Windows so that you can have Linux running inside of Windows. You can do that with any ISO image. You can take a hard drive, make it into an ISO image, and then run it off of Qemu and have a window in a window, sort of like Parallels. The thing that's great about it is that because it's open source, it's been ported to every platform, And Mac OS X on Intel is no exception. They have the Q emulator. That's on that list as well. Let's see if I can find another quick favorite. Miro, which we've talked about in the last podcast, as a matter of fact, available on that list. Handbrake, one of my favorite ways to rip DVDs.
Which I downloaded.
Seashore, which is essentially a GIMP-alike. Let's see what else we have here. CyberDuck, by far one of my favorite SFTP applications out there, only available for Mac OS X. FreeMind, a great mind managing application, mind mapping. Blender, which of course, for those of us who are familiar with 3D software and open source software know about from both Linux and Windows. One of the things that I came across that I did not know about before, although I'm really surprised that I didn't, was CC Publisher. CC Publisher allows you to upload Creative Commons licensed media that you choose to be Creative Commons licensed. Of course, we talk about Creative Commons just about every podcast. And this actually is a easy way to upload files right to the Internet Archive. And so all in one fell swoop, it sort of takes your media, CC licenses it according to your preferences, uploads it with the correct licensing to archive.org, and is just a really nice, smooth way to use your Mac in order to publish your Creative Commons licensed media. So, although there's other things that I certainly could bring up, I think probably the most important thing I could point you all to is the top 100 best open source Mac software list on ajaxflakes.com, which of course we'll link from the show notes. The other thing that I want to bring up is that we just found out that Dave Rebovich from Rider University, a locally famous political scientist and very active person at Rider University, passed. He was in class and he had a heart attack, and I just wanted to remember him here. It's very sad news, and we'll miss him a great deal.
Yeah, it was very much a shock. I went to go just check the local news headlines, and I saw that come up. And anybody who follows the wacky world of New Jersey politics knows Dave Rebovich's work. He was a political science professor at Rider, as well as the managing director of Rider's Institute for New Jersey Politics. PoliticsNJ.com, for which he wrote a column last year, named him the 16th most powerful figure in New Jersey state politics. And if the media needed a soundbite about the political goings-on in the state, Dave Rebovich was usually always there. New York Times, back in 2002, called him the answer man because, he had all the answers about New Jersey politics, at least as far as the media was concerned. And I think I just heard him on New Jersey 101.5, a soundbite from him the day before he passed. And it's going to be a real loss to the people of New Jersey, Rider University, obviously his family and friends. But it's a pretty big void to fill. So
he had just introduced me to his daughter, who just started at Rider this year. And it's just very sad. Yeah. Very sad, I feel for
her. Yeah, it's just a real shame. And he was 58. It's much too young. And he's going to be missed.
So thank you, Dave, for all of your great things that you've done for us. And we'll miss you greatly. Let's talk about technology again. Brian?
Sadly, Dave Rebovich's passing reminds me of Randy Pausch, who we discussed in the last podcast. He is a Carnegie Mellon professor, and he only has months to live. He is terminally ill with pancreatic cancer. He recently gave what was called his last lecture on how to live your childhood dreams. Well, one of Randy's childhood dreams was to play in the NFL. And because of the publicity generated by Randy's story, the Pittsburgh Steelers invited him to a practice recently where he was able to catch some passes thrown by Steelers wide receiver Hines Ward. So Randy's inspiration continues, teaching us that even with just months to live, it's never too late in some form or another to live out your childhood dreams. And I'm going to put the link to watch his last lecture in the show notes one more time. You owe it to yourselves to watch that. But now it's time to shift focus onto one of our favorite topics, the Recording Industry Association of America, better known as the RIAA. We haven't talked much about the RIAA recently, but this has been somewhat of a milestone month for the lobbying arm of the major record labels. First, the RIAA won the first file-sharing lawsuit to come to trial when a jury found that Jamie Thomas, a single mother from Brainerd, Minnesota, willfully shared 24 copyrighted music files over a file-sharing network and ordered her to pay the RIAA $222,000 in damages, or $9,250 per song. While I have no problems with the decision, I do think the penalty is a bit excessive, even though it is far less than the ridiculous $150,000 per song that the RIAA was looking for. But based on the generally accepted statistic that the record labels make about 70 cents on each track sold on iTunes, $9,200 represents more than 13,000 downloads. I find it hard to believe that 13,000 Kazaa users downloaded each of those 24 specific files from Thomas's shared folder. Realistically, the RIAA shouldn't be looking for more than $700 per song, which assumes what I think is a generous 1,000 downloads of any specific MP3 file on a file-sharing network. However, the RIAA can't do that because they need to, gouge these lawsuits because they need to pay for them. But Thomas has decided to go ahead with an appeal based on jury instruction number 15, which told jurors that they could find Thomas liable for copyright infringement if she made the recordings available over a file-sharing network, regardless of whether actual distribution has been shown. So that's the legal point that Thomas and her team are going to be pursuing. They're going to question the whole making available part of that instruction. The making available argument is one that is largely unsettled in U.S. courts. Judges have gone both ways, and it is yet to be determined whether or not just making a copyrighted file available on a file-sharing network is considered distribution under the Copyright Act. As Thomas wrote on her MySpace page, it is hoped that the RIAA will have to actually find proof that the files Thomas had made available on Kazaa had actually been distributed or downloaded by other users other than the RIAA's licensed agent, MediaCentury. So while the news was good for the RIAA on the courtroom front, things got decidedly dicey for it a few days later when the radio industry, represented by the National Association of Broadcasters, asked Congress to look into major label recording contracts. Why? Well, as we have mentioned during the talk about internet radio, terrestrial radio stations have never had to pay performance royalties for the music they play on the air, something netcasters have always done. Traditional radio stations have had to pay a royalty to songwriters, but not to the labels or the recording artists. Since the inception of the recording industry, radio station airplay was understood to be free promotion. However, earlier this year, the artists and the labels lobbied Congress to change this practice and force the radio industry to pay performance royalties. Strangely enough, the NAB told Congress, "Fine, we have no problems with that at all. Artists should be paid these royalties. But since we're going to be doing this, we think it would be helpful if Congress could take a closer look at standard language that goes into these major label recording contracts." The NAB even offered suggestions to Congress, saying, over the years, how much did the various record labels benefit financially from the sales of the performer witnesses at the July 31st, 2007 hearing? How does that compare to the compensation actually paid to the performers who testified on the 31st? And what is the minimum maximum average dollar amount the record labels receive from a performer's recording? What is the average amount that performers earn from the sale of each CD, from each download? I think the last thing the RIAA needs is for congressional hearings on recording contracts. So this should be an interesting situation to watch. And if things couldn't get any worse for the RIAA, British Rockers Radiohead decided to release their next CD in rainbows early, and at least initially, without a major record label.
Fantastic album.
I've heard bits and pieces of it. I'm probably going to download it at some point, but yeah, it does sound really good.
And but, it should be, well, not it should be said, but Radiohead is probably, if not my favorite band, one of my favorite bands, yes. I'm sure.
Yeah, so instead, Radiohead has allowed fans to download the CD directly from its website in 160K MP3 format and pay whatever they want. Now, the band has said it intends to sign with a new label to distribute the actual CD next year. But with a reported 1.2 million downloads of the album in its first 2 days of availability, you would think Radiohead might be onto something that the RIAA really doesn't want to catch on. And then things got even worse for the record industry. Because just after Radiohead put their CD available online without any major record label involved, word came out that Madonna was nearing a $120 million deal with concert promoter Live Nation to become her next record label, basically. The deal reportedly calls for 3 albums from Madonna, who will leave her longtime label Warner Brothers after her next CD is released in 2008. And it gives Live Nation the opportunity to tap into concert, recording, merchandising, and other lucrative revenue streams. Another important part of the deal is that ownership of recordings done under the terms of the Live Nation contract would eventually revert back to Madonna. In contrast, Warner owns the rights to Madonna's catalog of earlier recordings. So it's been fun to watch these events unfold in the world of the RIAA. At first, you had the recording industry winning the file-sharing lawsuit and feeling all good about themselves, but then the sequence of events turned decidedly negative from the standpoint of the major record labels. To me, it was almost like the RIAA won a battle and almost immediately found itself starting to lose the war. There are major changes coming for the recording industry. It's inevitable, and with the recent decisions by Universal and EMI to sell DRM-free tracks online, you can tell there are forces within the labels to try new things, but I think there may be just too many old-school idealists holding the industry back, but I think one way or another, change is going to come, and hopefully it will usher in a business model that is fair to the labels, the artists, the songwriters, the distributors, the broadcasters, the netcasters, the retailers, and most importantly, the fans, the consumers.
Well, it's very interesting that you make that list, because in my ethics class, we really focus on stakeholders as a model for determining ethics. And what you're essentially doing is saying, you know, what's best for everybody, not what's best for consumers or what's best for a particular band or what's best for a particular, you know, label. And in the ethical view of what Radiohead is doing, you know, do you think that they, in a way, have an obligation to EMI or whoever, but the idea is that quite possibly you could argue that Radiohead is doing an ethical disservice to the label, because without the label they would not be in the situation that they're in, where they're able to essentially, you know, if Radiohead didn't make any money on In Rainbows, nobody in that band would starve, because they're all, you know, trillionaires. Well, that's probably an exaggeration, but I'm sure they're doing fine. My point is that it's sort of like biting the hand that feeds it, you know? And I wonder, you know, if it sounds like it's definitely benefiting the consumer, and it's definitely benefiting Radiohead. It's definitely benefiting all the advocates for openness and taking down orders, because the tracks that are downloaded have no DRM whatsoever. So the people who are advocating DRM, which have their own ethical issues, of course, how would they feel about it? You know, how do they feel about it? I'm sure they're not thrilled. RIAA, for example.
Well, I think obviously any up and coming act is going to need, you know, some kind of label support. You know,
maybe not.
Well, at this point, that the established acts like Radiohead, Madonna can afford to do this. Paul McCartney, he left a major label. He signed with Starbucks, their new record label. So things are happening. Nine Inch Nails is another example of established acts using methods of distribution, methods of getting their music out there that go against the major label's stance, their traditional business model. And hopefully these are the moves that will start breaking down those walls, and the up and coming acts won't need the major labels. Hopefully the internet, serves its purpose and allows these upstart acts to, promote themselves without the need of a major record label. But, it's a long way from that right now, but you can tell that there's a shift going on. There's evidence of it, and hopefully a change will come sooner than later. But now it's time for the Technology and the Arts events calendar.
This is your Technology and the Arts events calendar. World Cafe Live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania presents new paintings by David Lawrence from October 10th through November 8th, 2007. The Brooklyn-born Lawrence is a recipient of the prestigious Creative Arts Award, and his latest series of works combines astronomy, numerology, geometry, and physics with the imagery, symbolism, textures, and patterns of indigenous cultures to create pyramidism. For more information about the exhibit, call World Cafe Live at 215-222-1400 or visit www.worldcafelive.com. Weather Report, Art and Climate Change is an exhibition presented in collaboration with Echo Arts and runs through December 21st, 2007 at the Boulder Museum of Contemporary Art in Boulder, Colorado. This exhibit partners the art and scientific communities to create a visual dialogue surrounding climate change, with artwork being shown in the museum and in partnering venues, as well as in outdoor site-specific locations throughout Boulder that will activate personal and public change. For more information, visit the museum's website at www.bmoca.org or call 303-443-2122. Virtual Unreality, a new interactive exhibition at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, California, runs through January 7, 2008, and brings together three digital artworks by internationally known artists that use game technology to explore the unreality of virtual landscapes. For more information and exhibit hours, please visit www.exploratorium.edu or call 415-561-0363. On Thursday, November 8, 2007, the Princeton Laptop Orchestra will be performing at the National Academy of Sciences Museum in Washington, D.C. More details will be available soon on PLORC's website at plork.cs.princeton.edu. To stay informed about these and other events related to technology and the arts, please remember to check out the Technology and the Arts events page at techarts.wordpress.com.
It looks like we are just about at the end of another Technology in the Arts podcast. John, anything you would like to share with the audience at this time?
Well, as always, I'd like to say to our listeners that if they have an idea for a story or know about a show or event related to technology or art, to let us know about it by emailing us at technology.arts@gmail.com. Also, feel free to send an email just to say hi. And you're always welcome to leave a comment on the Technology in the Arts blog at techarts.wordpress.com.
Well, that closes the curtain on another Technology in the Arts podcast. Stay tuned for more news and resources related to Technology in the Arts when we come back with our next show on Halloween night, Wednesday, October 31st, 2007. So until then, for Technology in the Arts, this is Brian Kelly.
And this is John Lemazny. Take care.
The views expressed by the hosts of Technology and the Arts are not necessarily those of guests of the program. Conversely, thoughts and opinions expressed by guests of Technology and the Arts are not necessarily shared by the hosts. For more information about the podcast you have just heard, please visit Technology and the Arts on the web at techarts.wordpress.com.